morning and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan, South Sudan, and the rest of Africa this Wednesday, February 12, 2025. A Sudanese civil society activist says the prospect for peace in Sudan is very far.
But very few political actors, very few constituencies in Sudan can really rally behind these armed groups unless they have an ethnic affiliation with them or that they see that their ethnic interests would be somewhat addressed by these groups.
And Democratic lawmakers in Washington are criticizing what they call the Trump administration's extreme effort to reshape the U.S. government.
If you want to make cuts, then you do it through a debate in Congress, not lawlessly by just implementing them. We want waste. We want to make sure waste isn't done, but they're cutting out the meat that's going to hurt millions of American families.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A recent discussion at the Washington-based Atlantic Council focused on Sudan's road to peace. Khalid Kher is a civil society activist who has been engaged in the search for peace in her country. She told participants at the council that Sudan's warring parties are not respecting their commitments to end the conflict in the country.
You know, history tells us that the trajectory of these kinds of wars in Sudan is around 20 years, and we're only in year two, heading into year three. So it seems like we have a long way to go in terms of getting any kind of resolution that will bring about some level of stability. And even if the war doesn't last 20 years, we have, unfortunately, a set of actors that have now mushroomed. We have, rather than two main belligerent actors what we started with in April of 2023, or four, really, if you count the non-signatories of the peace agreement, we now have maybe a dozen, maybe more. And this makes it extremely difficult for, you know, outside actors to try and corral these groups together into some kind of mediation process, particularly if the sequencing is ceasefire first, then political agreement. Quite obviously, no armed actor who has realized that picking up a gun is the price of admission to a future political career is going to put down their gun until they know what that future political career looks like.
She says the warring groups are interested in ending the conflict through the barrel of the gun. Kher says ceasefire agreements have not been respected by the groups in Sudan.
At least some modicum of a sketching out of what the lay of the land will look like in the post-war political dispensation, I think, would need to precede any sort of serious or sincere attempt at a ceasefire. We haven't seen that thus far, not in the Jeddah talks that were led by the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, not through the African Union or the Arab League or any of the different sort of mediation pathways that we have seen. The one that had, I'd say, the most success in terms of they were able to get somewhere was the Manama Agreement. And that makes sense when you consider that the Manama Agreement is effectively a security pact made by security officials. It's not a diplomatic foray. And but what we saw there again was that as soon as the Sudanese Armed Forces members signed and came back to Port Sudan, that agreement immediately disavowed.
Conflict erupted in Sudan's capital Khartoum in April 15, 2023. Since then, the actors involved in the conflict have not been able to agree on how to end the conflict. Kair says other actors in Sudan's conflict could prolong the scenario in the country. She says the two leaders in Sudan's conflict are not interested in peaceful settlement.
And so we have to think about, you know, the non-armed actors that are obviously very clearly in positions of power here, particularly the Islamists of the Bashir era, who have taken up sort of a different guise, but very much remain at the heart of things. And, you know, and people say, will they come back? Is that what they're trying to do? You know, they're already back. I think we can see that very clearly in the way that different actors, the Sudanese armed forces in particular, have been forced to conduct politics. And so, you know, despite the recent, for example, the remarks by the head of the Sudanese Armed Forces, General Burhan, about sort of this amnesty and, you know, extending the olive branch to different political actors that he spent the past 2 years effectively pillorying and threatening. You know, that's going to fall on deaf ears. It's going to fall very flat because, of course, no one trusts this man. This is a man who led a coup alongside General Himeti against civilian rule. And so actually neither Burhan nor Himeti can really sketch out, and they haven't really done so.
Khaloud says the conflict in Sudan has polarized the Sudanese people. She says the Sudanese people have a long way before they can see an end to the violence.
But very few political actors, very few constituencies in Sudan can really rally behind these armed groups unless they have an ethnic affiliation with them, or that they see that their ethnic interests would be somewhat addressed by these groups. So it leaves us in a position where a war that was started over control over resources, control over, you know, the different types of different levers of the state, etc., has now become, especially the economy, has now become much, much more ethnicized. And that kind of war is very intractable. So even if we see one entity, for example, the Sudanese Armed Forces, take the capital, Khartoum, that's not going to bring about an end to this war, because there has been 2 years at least, and actually much longer than that, of incredible amounts of hate speech, incredible amount of racially based political mobilizing that unfortunately is trying to undo a lot of the good foundational aspects of peaceful coexistence and peaceful change.
That's Khaloud Kher, a Sudanese civil society activist, speaking at an event organized by the Washington-based Atlantic Council. Still in Washington, the Trump administration says it is carrying out a review of foreign aid programs, and the main U.S. agency for humanitarian assistance, USAID. Veronica Iglesias Baldres reports on what changes critics of the agency are proposing.
I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear.
With his America First approach, U.S. President Donald Trump has promised sweeping changes to how the United States interacts with the rest of the world. Vice President J.D. Vance explained the approach during an interview with Fox News' Hannity show.
The simple concept, America first, it doesn't mean you hate anybody else. It means that you have leadership. And President Trump has been very clear about this, that puts the interests of American citizens first.
In that context, President Trump ordered a 90-day freeze starting January 20th to all foreign assistance pending a government review, with some exceptions, which U.S. Secretary Marco Rubio recently clarified.
We've issued waivers for programs that make all the sense in the world. They make America safer. They make America stronger. If it's providing food or medicine or anything that is saving lives and is immediate and urgent, you're not included in the freeze.
The U.S. Agency for International Development, which manages most of the foreign assistance programs, is under intense scrutiny, which some analysts say is necessary. Brian Clark is a defense policy analyst with the Hudson Institute. He was interviewed via Skype.
There's maybe parts of the U.S. Agency for International Development that might need to be downsized or repurposed to try to refocus them on U.S. national security objectives rather than merely promoting cultural norms that we find to be beneficial and useful here, but that may not be desired by the target country.
Foreign affairs analyst at George Washington University, Sean Roberts, via Skype.
One of the things the Trump administration has been very concerned about is USAID's focus on diversity, equity, inclusion around the world. I think that has been mishandled to a certain degree by USAID, because some countries around the world are not ready for accepting, for example, gay marriage.
USAID workers have taken to the streets in recent days to defend their work and reject the potential dismantling of their agency. USAID contractor Mieka would not give her last name.
We work by not by forcing people to have respect for America or by telling people to have certain values, but by supporting them in the ways that they feel that they need, and in doing so, making the world a better place for all of us.
More targeted USAID investments in foreign countries could yield better returns, says defense policy expert Brian Clark.
Investments in humanitarian aid, even if they don't necessarily create an ally that's going to be able to support U.S. interests, is good because it promotes U.S. soft power and promotes the U.S. position in the world.
While the review of USAID programs is underway, officials have lifted the suspension on some programs, such as the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR. But local clinics did not immediately reopen. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
Still in Washington, the Trump administration last month paused funding for the U.S. Agency for International Development amid reports that it may put under State Department control as the president seeks to align it with his America First policy. Britain's recent similar move to restructure its foreign aid could offer lessons for Washington. Andrew Ridgewell reports from London.
The battle over the future of the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, echoes a similar debate in Britain. In 2020, then Prime Minister Boris Johnson merged the Department for International Development, or DFID, with the Foreign Office.
This will unite our aid with our diplomacy and bring them together in our international effort. The Foreign Secretary will be empowered to decide which countries receive or cease to receive British aid while delivering a single UK strategy for each country.
Johnson's decision chimed with his Conservative Party's scepticism over aid spending, says analyst Tim Durrant of the Institute for Government.
Not always aligned with what he thought the UK's foreign policy priorities should be. I think there was definitely a sense among those on the right of UK politics that DFID was a bit too big for its boots, perhaps, or needed better oversight.
But the move shocked the aid sector, says analyst Mark Miller of ODI Global.
Because you now had a set of senior managers in place who were largely focused on supporting the UK's national interest, however you might interpret that, rather than previously a very clear mandate where aid was meant to be prioritised towards poverty reduction.
In 2020, Britain's aid spending was also cut from 0.7% of gross national income, the highest in the G7 group of developed nations, to 0.5%. Spending was redirected. Almost a third of Britain's aid budget, some $5.2 billion, was spent on supporting refugees inside the country in 2023. Aid spending also reflected Britain's geopolitical priorities, says Miller.
There was more attention being paid to trying to outcompete, China or Russia, particularly in Asia Pacific, trying to upscale investment in these regions where historically aid had been much more focused on Africa.
The creation of Britain's Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office, or FCDO, offers lessons for Washington as it mulls the future of USAID, says Durrant.
In the UK instance, there was a sort of reputational hit. DFID had a very strong brand, as does USAID. There's also the kind of knock-on impact it has on morale and productivity. I think this is particularly going to be a case in the US. But there is now a sense that the FCDO is the sort of the one voice, and that there are people who have both development and diplomacy experience who are representing the UK. In countries where the UK is spending development money.
Durrant added that strong oversight of spending is vital to retaining public support for foreign aid. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
Listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, Democrats are criticizing the Trump administration for what they call extreme efforts to reshape the U.S. government. Find out why after the break.
Hey. Hello, listener of South Sudan in Focus. We have an exciting new segment dubbed Words of Wisdom. We want to hear your thoughtful proverbs that echo through your community. This is another chance for you to share wisdom from your roots. All you need to do is record a proverb in a language of your choice, tell us its English translation and what it means. Keep it brief, authentic, and represent your community. Your recorded proverb shall be sampled on South Sudan in Focus every Wednesday. Send your recording via our WhatsApp number, +1 202 630 8011. That is +1 202 630 8011.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Our words of wisdom for this Wednesday comes from along the River Nile.
Hi, Voice of America. This is Kenny Wani David from South Sudan, Juba. I have a Mundari proverb. Say, Kinjiri abodan dingi darojo I diniki inagajo goma kungurupi. It said, if a bird stay too long on the tree, it is bite a stone.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. President Donald Trump is doubling down on his demand that Jordan's King Abdullah II support his plan to take over Gaza and permanently take in Palestinians. Tuesday's White House meeting came amid a possible collapse of fragile ceasefire between Hamas and Israel. White House bureau chief Patsy with Akwasora has this report.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip fear the return of war after Hamas's threat to delay the next planned release of Israeli hostages and U.S. President Donald Trump's call to cancel the ceasefire. As he hosted Jordan's King Abdullah II at the White House Tuesday, Trump doubled down on his plan to take over Gaza.
I think it's going to be something that's going to be magnificent for the Palestinians. They're going to be in love with it. I did very well with real estate. I can tell you about real estate. They're going to be in love with it.
The Palestinians, along with Jordan, Egypt, and various other countries, have rejected Trump's plan to forcibly relocate an estimated 1.9 million Gaza residents into neighboring countries. But other than saying he would immediately receive 2,000 children in Gaza sick with cancer and other illnesses, King Abdullah declined Trump's invitation to share his counteroffer.
I think we have to keep in mind that there is a plan from Egypt and the Arab countries. We're being invited by Mohammed bin Salman to discussions in Riyadh. I think the point is how do we make this work in a way that is good for everybody?
It's a high-stakes meeting for Abdullah, who must maintain ties with a key ally whom Jordan depends on for foreign assistance. Trump hinted Monday he would withhold aid, but backtracked on Tuesday. Many Jordanians are descendants of displaced Palestinians. If Abdullah supports Trump's plans, it will create major political and economic problems and allow Hamas to enter, says Gaith Al-Omari of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy.
Hamas could create not only domestic problems in terms of terror, but also there's a fear that Jordan might then become a staging ground for attacks on Israel. All of these things will create very, very severe threats to Jordan's stability and maybe even survival.
Al-Omari said Trump's takeover plan removes the incentive for Hamas to continue the ceasefire. On Monday, the U.S.-designated terror group threatened to delay the next planned release of hostages, alleging Israeli truce violations. Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu responded with the same ultimatum.
The decision I passed unanimously in the cabinet is this. If Hamas does not return our hostages by Saturday noon, the ceasefire will end. And the IDF will return to intense fighting until Hamas is finally defeated.
Israel will hand over Gaza to the U.S. after the war, Trump has said.
We're not going to buy anything. We're going to have it, and we're going to keep it, and we're going to make sure that there's going to be peace, and there's not going to be any problem, and nobody's going to question it.
These Gazans would disagree. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, Washington.
Still in Washington, Democratic lawmakers are criticizing what they call the Trump administration's extreme efforts to reshape the U.S. government, vowing to oppose those changes despite limited political capital in both chambers of the U.S. Congress. Republicans, however, defend the move, saying attempts to stop fraud and waste are long overdue. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reports from Washington.
A second week of protests from Democratic lawmakers concerned about President Donald Trump's attempts to reshape the U.S. government. Despite limited political capital in both chambers of the U.S. Congress, Democrats vowing to fight what they call the Trump administration's extreme efforts to close down government agencies and immediately lay off federal workers. Chuck Schumer is the top Democrat in the U.S. Senate.
If you want to make cuts, then you do it through a debate in Congress, not lawlessly by just implementing them. We want waste. We want to make sure waste isn't done, but they're cutting out the meat that's going to hurt millions of American families.
Republicans have defended the work of the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, led by billionaire Elon Musk, saying attempts to stop fraud and waste are long overdue. Tom Emmer serves in House Republican leadership.
The Democrat Party's tantrums are exactly why they hold no majority in Congress and their candidate is not in the White House. DOGE is rightly pulling back the curtains that have been closed for years. And the outrage we are seeing across the aisle is baffling but not surprising given their record of mismanagement of taxpayer dollars.
Democrats are vowing to fight for protections for government agencies or withhold their votes in upcoming government funding talks. Pete Aguilar serves in House Democratic leadership.
There's very little appetite to help Republicans when we don't trust that Donald Trump's going to spend the resources that we've allocated for education, for health care, or even, we don't know, for our own defense. With Elon Musk and his unelected friends running through and combing through the federal system.
Democrats have had some success temporarily stopping Trump's executive orders in the U.S. court system. But one analyst told VOA other changes will take time. Casey Burgat is Legislative Affairs Program Director at the George Washington University.
We haven't yet seen the grassroots mobilization yet, but that's the one most indirect to levers of power within Washington, D.C. It takes time for those messages to resonate with the American people, them to coordinate with each other to gain enough volume to reach members of Congress or enough members of Congress.
But Speaker of the House Mike Johnson said Tuesday the Democratic Party has very little power.
There's no identified leader of the party. They don't have a clear vision. They seem rudderless. In hopes of finding themselves, they've latched onto this new shiny object called the rule of law. Well, we'd like to welcome them to the concept. It would be admirable if they hadn't spent the last 4 years with their heads buried in the sand while Biden literally trampled over the rule of law with no objection.
The short-term agreement funding the U.S. government is set to expire March 14th. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
From Washington, we go to Southern Africa, where the Malawian government has announced the immediate implementation of a ban on the production, importation, use, and export of thin plastic less than 60 microns. The decision comes 9 years after legal battles with manufacturing companies that resisted the ban. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Environment experts say thin plastics take a long time to degrade and therefore they contaminate soil for a long time when buried. However, Malawi banned the use of thin plastics in March 2015 in response to global concerns around the environmental damage from thin plastics. However, a series of court injunctions secured by the country's plastics manufacturers delayed its implementation. the plastics manufacturers, mainly business people of Indian origin, argued that the ban would negatively impact local communities, industry, and the economy. They argued that the government should instead collaborate with the Plastics Manufacturers Association to address plastic waste management. However, in his ruling last week, High Court Judge Howard Pemba removed the injunctions. Judge Pemba also dismissed an appeal from the plastic manufacturers for a judicial review on the matter, saying such successful actions on the same issue were an abuse of the court process. Yusuf Nkungula is the Principal Secretary for Natural Resources and Climate Change in Malawi. He told reporters Monday that the court's verdict means the ban on thin plastics stands and its implementation is with immediate effect. Nkungula said those violating the ban will face law, as stated in regulations against thin plastics.
First of all, people can be in prison between maybe 3 months and upwards based on the severity of the offence. And secondly, the regulations also provide for confiscation of any equipment that is used for producing, manufacturing, distribution and even the use of thin plastics.
Malawi has long struggled with plastic pollution. A 2019 policy brief by the United Nations Development Programme estimated that the country produces at least 75,000 tons of plastic annually, with 80% being single-use and non-recyclable. Environmental activists in Malawi have long complained that plastics are frequently discarded in household rubbish pits and dumped in landfills, clogging gutters on roadsides and cluttering rivers in urban centers. Wilfred Chadewa is the director of the Malawi Environment Protection Authority. He says efforts are underway to educate people on the ban and that using thin plastics is now an offense.
We use different types of media, the print and electronic media. We also work with educational institutions. We work with community groups to pass on the message on what has happened with regards to the law and what the expectation is.
Kadewa says people should now start using alternatives like paper bags and other carriers. However, Principal Secretary Nkungula says the government will soon conduct nationwide inspections to ensure compliance with the ban. For VOA Africa, I am Lamek Masina in Blanta.
That's all we prepared for you this Wednesday, February 12, 2025. We now leave you with the song El Corniche by Gawahara. Listening to an Egyptian musician who calls herself Gawahara and the song El Corniche. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio One here in Washington. For more information on our programs, log on to www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer Patrick Dare, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.